I'm here today with Astrid Atkinson, the co-founder and CEO of Camu Energy. Let's jump right in. This is going to be a conversation as part of a series we're doing on electrification. And I'm really excited to have you here today and to hear more about Camu. Do you want to just say a bit about who you are and your company and what your role is?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really nice to be here. Yeah, so I'm Astrid. I'm the CEO and one of the three co-founders for Camu Energy. We do grid management software as a service. We work primarily with utilities and seek to provide them with next generation software technology for managing distribution grids. I'm happy to talk more about that as we go along.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And say more about what that means exactly and say, you know, what's orchestration, agility, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, taking the existing software development models and existing networks and computing models and data centers and all of this stuff that makes up the fabric of the internet and think about how to use it really differently in a mode which basically allowed us to take advantage of highly reliable connectivity throughout really all of the world to do massively distributed computing while maintaining the reliability model of the more centralized networks and more centralized systems that had been the norm up until that point. And while there's nothing particularly wrong with it in terms of being able to fulfill that traditional model of operation, the world is changing really quickly around that network model and around how we produce and consume energy.
Okay, so to attempt to recap, historical energy production has been centralized in big power plants and whatnot.
Big power plants.
Clean energy resources, also known as DERs, distributed energy resources, are all over the place. And they also, you know, aren't as constant, right, as a sort of a base load utility power plant, right? And so we need software to kind of manage all this, these distributed resources.
Yeah. You know, I think when we think about the transition to a clean, decarbonized energy system, the question is not, you know, do we have the technology to do that? We do have the majority of the technologies mm-hmm. that we're going to need to operate fully decarbonized grids today to provide, you know, decarbonized energy. But it's a lot of different pieces. It's not one big power plant that you womp out in the middle of nowhere and draw a big transmission line out to, and then you kind of turn it up and down over the course of the next year or two.
Yep.
It's a lot of different technologies that have really different operating profiles from generation to storage to load flexibility. And getting reliable performance and reliable service out of all of those resources requires managing them really differently than the way that it's a grid today.
And say a bit about looking forward, you know, we're going to be putting lots and lots of more resources along the lines of solar, wind, and storage onto the grid as well. And that won't that create even more trouble for those who manage grids?
Well, I like to think of it as more opportunity, for sure. Yes, certainly under today's existing models, both around guaranteeing power supply in a 24/7 fashion with decarbonized resources, that looks really different when you're looking at wind and solar and storage and hydro and nuclear than it does when you're looking at, you know, five or six coal plants. It doesn't mean it's necessarily worse. It can be better in some ways because, you know, coal plants also have their failure profiles and their sensitivities to weather and water supply and heat and all of these things. And so I think that in some ways there's potential for improving the overall reliability of the system by quite a bit when we think about the opportunities that are presented by having energy that's a lot more local and has different sensitivity profiles to weather conditions. But it's definitely, you know, it requires a change in our generation fleet, in the way that we use electricity, in the way that we use the network. And so when we think about electrification in particular, there's a lot of load growth implied by electrification. And you guys have probably heard stats on this from other guests, but really briefly, you know, we're looking at potentially, you know, maybe 2 to 3x load growth on our grid overall, but it's going to be really spiky. It's going to show up at different times in different places. We get quite a bit of efficiency gain in our energy system as a whole by beginning with electricity rather than beginning with kind of gas to boil water, to spin turbines to generate electricity. And so, you know, in some ways, the transition will save us some of the energy usage that our energy system accounts for today. But it's still a really big change. Any really big change is a really big challenge. The other thing is the network capacity, particularly at the edges of the existing grid, becomes a big issue as you move forward. This hasn't been an issue for at least 10 or 20 years. Most utilities haven't seen load growth in that time. And a really big part of the reason for that is increased efficiency in consumer technologies. So if you talk to someone at a utility and you ask them, what was the most influential technology that has rolled out in the last 20 years in terms of energy usage, they'll tell you that it's LED light bulbs. Because that transition from incandescent light bulbs where, you know, you were lighting your living room with a 60-watt bulb to LED light bulbs where it's maybe a 5 or 6-watt bulb is really, really visible in their long-term usage projections, in their long-term load projections. And so in a lot of cases, utilities have really kind of gotten out of the habit or, you know, lost the opportunity to grow their business with growing electrical load. And while a growing business is always something that, you know, a business owner is excited about, it's also something that comes with a lot of additional system costs. So as we look at the challenges associated with dramatically increasing load on our, particularly our distribution grid, there's a really significant set of challenges around, you know, on the one hand, kind of rising to the opportunity of, you know, lots more electrical load, but on the other hand, managing system costs associated with upgrades, of upgrading pretty much all network capacity everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And resilience as well, right, is an important issue.
Yeah, and this is where I think there's a set of really interesting both challenges and opportunities ahead of us. Now, I live in California. I'm in the California Coastal Mountains area, just outside the Bay Area. And my power's been off for the last 2 days. That's, you know, obviously not my favorite, but it's also not unusual for where I live. And it's become increasingly a factor over the last sort of 6 to 7 years. You know, it's not just the winter storm profile, which has always been a factor for the area where I live. But we also introduce increased fire risk, and we see public safety power shutoffs. We see a lot more blue sky outages. You know, you really see the stress that environmental change is putting on grid infrastructure all around us. Mm-hmm. There's really only two solutions to improving resilience in this kind of model. One is we could really, really invest in the physical infrastructure of the network. We could look at sectionalizers. We could look at undergrounding. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that the network mm-hmm. operator could do to, if they wanted to invest in increasing reliability. But as a consumer, you're really, your only option is to invest in resilience technologies that are specific to your use case. So, you know, in my case, I'm going to put in a bunch of batteries at my house. Mm-hmm. Yep. Right now, when the power goes out, I turn on my fossil fuel generator. And when the power goes out, all my neighbors turn on their fossil fuel generators. So, you know, if we look at like what is the impact of increased climate-driven instability, it's a lot more backup generation that is really fossil heavy and really locally polluting. And it also leads to people like me investing in consumer solutions for resilience that begin to change both the physical characteristics and the economics of the grid. So when I become basically self-producing for energy at my house, I am effectively no longer contributing to the economic foundation under which the grid operates today. Now, this is pretty good for me in the sense that I save some money and my power doesn't go out anymore, which is a strict improvement from where I stand today. It's not necessarily good for my neighbors. It's not necessarily good for the broader question of public access to energy in California either. And this is why utilities get really worried when they look at this trend. And so in my mind, one of the biggest challenges ahead of us is not, can you get more resilient power? Because the answer to that is like, you know, yes, if you're willing to pay a lot of money, or yes, if you're wealthy, absolutely. The question is more, what is the model of resilience that supports the access to electricity as a public good?
Got it. And this is a category, right? Orchestration, agility, resilience.
Absolutely.
So there are other companies doing this. What makes you all Kemu unique? And like, what's your secret sauce? Something you do that others just can't?
So there's a couple of things that we do that are a little bit different. You know, I think the biggest is that because we come from a background, you know, technologically speaking, in very large scale systems technology, there's a set of foundational capabilities around incorporating very large amounts of big data and real-time data into understanding of the system, into planning, but also real-time operations of the system, that we kind of bring with us as DNA, right? A lot of the members of our current team have been, you know, personally on call for managing critical systems, personally responsible for designing systems that are running at 5 nines of reliability or better in a globally distributed network. And you know, we have a fairly broad view of what it takes to do that. You know, software is really important. Software is an enabler, but hardware is important. Network capacity is important. Operational models and operator roles are important. Thinking about how all the pieces come together to produce, you know, a system which operates overall to accomplish a certain set of goals is something that, you know, we have a fair bit of experience with doing and with designing in a greenfield environment. Now, from a technology perspective, we're a cloud-first company. We begin with data integration across the entire existing grid. You know, because we are a modern software company, we also bring, be unsurprised to hear, a ton of machine learning, forecasting, and modeling into what we do. Mm-hmm. So we take all that real-time data that's out there, we incorporate it into a composite real-time view of the grid. We run it through a ton of data pipelines, do, you know, ML-driven data interpolation, forecasting, et cetera, to fill in gaps, correct the data, provide real-time forecasts where real-time data isn't available, and provide what we would effectively consider a synthetic pseudo-real-time view of grid conditions. This is important because the state of data availability in the grid today is not very good. And most of the software systems in the space today are on-prem and therefore pretty constrained in terms of the volume of data and the volume of processing that they can handle. So we do all of that, and then we use that data to inform operators, but also to provide operational controls that use that data for managing local resources in a way that's grid aware. So, you know, that might mean managing the capacity of an individual transformer when there's multiple EVs below it. That might mean managing the capacity at an individual circuit or feeder in normal and atypical switching states. That could mean managing a distributed VPP to replace supply from a coal plant. Mm-hmm. Depends on the use case. But it's really like using that data to provide real-time operational capabilities that's a little bit different about what we do.
Got it. And say a bit about the basics of the company, how much you've raised, some of your investors, any customers you can mention, how big you are, et cetera.
Sure, yeah. So we're coming up on 4 years old, and we've raised about $20 million to date. That was pre-seed, friends and family around from a number, mostly former colleagues. We raised a seed round in 2019, and that was co-led by Congruent, who are very well regarded clean tech investor.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, that's how we were connected, in fact, for this discussion. At Congruent, yeah.
They've been wonderful partners. I really appreciate their expertise and knowledge in the clean tech space. They've been really great to work with. And then the other party that co-led that round was Wave Capital, which is mostly tech-focused, mm-hmm. but with a particular focus on businesses that have a market thesis. And a core part of what we do is around providing economic opportunities for local resources to participate in the grid. And so that's kind of how that came together.
Like demand response, that sort of thing?
Yeah. Okay. The real question is like, so for the batteries that I'm going to put in, if they serve only me, that fundamentally harms the grid and my neighbors, really, because I'm not paying for the network. And I'm basically sort of taking away, you know, bread and butter from the cost model of operating that network, even though I still rely on it.
And you can't be called upon in a moment when agility is needed, right? Because you're isolated.
Yeah, at least not under the current kind of operational model of the grid. Mm-hmm. So if we think about a world where my batteries become assets rather than liabilities, like what does that look like? What does it take for me to let my utility call on those batteries as a day-to-day blue sky asset while I still get value from them as a resilience asset when the power goes out? And what would be the value of those batteries? Like, could they help to offset load on my transformer? Could they help to provide some amount of day-to-day energy supply for my neighbors? Could they help to defer the cost of upgrading a feeder? All of those services have a potential financial value. Today, there's not really a great way for me to get paid for that. And until my utility can pay me for it, I'm not going to let them touch my batteries. So a lot of what we do is try to bring all that data that we have about, you know, needs on the grid and opportunities for local resources to participate and translate that into ways for utilities or market operators to pay local customers for access to those resources.
Yep. I want to zoom out a bit and talk about electrification more broadly. But before we do, your website mentions your mascot is the capybara. your official utensil of Camus is the spork. You want to explain that?
So the capybara is among the cutest of the mammal kingdom, I think.
Indeed. Like a giant guinea pig, right?
Yeah. Yes, they're definitely worth a Google for capybaras with other animals, which is a very wholesome Google image search that will provide you with a lot of joy. Capybaras have a unique ability to get along with other creatures. There are many, many, many pictures of capybaras balancing ducks on their heads or monkeys or turtles or cats or baby goats or chilling with alligators. And we really liked that. That resonated with us because I think there's been a longstanding tradition in the energy sector for companies being fundamentally pretty secretive about what they do and thinking that, like, if you tell anyone what you're doing, they'll take your secrets from you and we'll beat
right.
you. Whereas I really don't think that it's going to be possible to decarbonize our energy system for any single company working alone. You know, we say internally that decarbonization is a team sport. The capybara is everybody's friend. And so, you know, we really liked that kind of image of being able to kind of generally build connections with all the creatures of the animal kingdom because of this idea that working together with other companies within our ecosystem and other participants within our ecosystem is a really important part of being successful.
Got it. I like that. And the spork?
Oh, sporks are cool. They do a little bit of everything. They're very practical.
And it's fun to say.
Fundamental piece of camping equipment. Easy to hand out to people, really just bring people a lot of joy for no quite discernible reason.
And it's fun to say the word spork, spork,
it
spork,
is.
Spork. Yeah. All right. So let's zoom out a bit and talk about electrification. You know, the goal of this conversation and a number of them in a series is to explore, you know, what is electrification and in particular the role of software.
Yeah.
So the central question here we're trying to answer is what's the role of software in electrification? So do you want to say just really high level your view of like what electrification is and then your take on the role of the software? Obviously, you are one of those software providers for electrification.
Yeah. So when we talk about electrification, we're really talking about transitioning things that use energy to using electricity as their energy supply rather than other sources. So things that might directly use fossil fuels today, such as heat or transportation or industrial applications, would need to transition to using electricity, which is ideally produced from clean sources as their energy supply. And so when we think about this in the grid context, that typically falls down into basically those three categories. It's heating, it's transportation, and it's industrial uses. All of those are primarily fossil sourced today. And we need to transition them to clean energy sources, which by and large means transitioning them to electricity. So that's just kind of the working definition that I would use.
Mm-hmm. And as you do, that means a lot more electricity is needed. That gets
that's
to
right.
your increase in load, right? And
then, that's right.
And then everything gets more complex and harder.
Yeah. And so as you do that, you don't necessarily need all of those users of energy to be grid connected or directly deriving their electricity from a centrally connected grid. But the expectation is that quite a lot of it probably will. And that, you know, even if you can get to a point where you can completely self-generate, you know, 95% of your energy, let's say my house with my solar panels and
right.
batteries
yeah.
I'm about to put in, the long tail of that last 5% is pretty valuable. The central connectivity that we have from the network as it stands today basically allows us to you know add a couple of nines to any individual
right. like reliable energy base load, for instance,
production yeah. and consumption. So we've got to assume that a lot of that load does come onto the grid, and the grid is a physical network. Networks have capacity constraints. This is something that anyone who's worked in the software space will have, or the networking space will have, a ton of familiarity with. And if you look at recent really big areas of innovation and optimization in managing network capacity, you know, there's a couple of things that we can point to around capacity within the communications network, capacity within the internet. And what we've overwhelmingly seen there is that having more active network management from a whole system perspective and using software to do a lot of the core work of networking can gain a lot of efficiency within the physical constraints of the network. So one example that I like to use is after Google bought YouTube, there was a really big sort of set of questions around how to continue scaling YouTube as a business because the expense of shipping cat videos across the internet is very high.
Right.
It's fundamentally a bandwidth constrained application, right? Yep. You need to get the existing network to do a ton more work in order to scale that business. And it was actually one of the reasons YouTube needed to be bought because they did not have an answer to how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so a really big innovation in how we make use of the network was at Google, it was an implementation of much smarter and more distributed edge serving capacity.
Right.
So you could kind of think of it as being similar from switching from those centrally located power supply, you know, power plants to a whole bunch of smaller distributed power suppliers, which used less of the network because they were closer to the customer.
Right. Does the term CDN sound familiar?
That's right.
Content distribution network. Yeah. Limelight and all that stuff. Yeah.
We built an internal content distribution network at Google to do this.
Yeah. So similar to the Limelights of the world who were, you know, optimizing where content sits so it can be accessed quickly and not have to fly all over the world every time someone clicks a button.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Okay. And so is there an analogy here to Camus then?
Absolutely. Yeah. So when you think about like when does it make sense to build a lot of distributed capacity? Well, it makes sense to build a lot of distributed capacity when you need to optimize use of network bandwidth. And that's really what we're talking about when we talk about electrification on the grid. How do we optimize network bandwidth on the grid to account for the rising cost of needing it to do a lot more work?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, similar to building a whole bunch of like very distributed serving locations, you know, first hundreds of smaller data centers and then sort of tens of thousands of edge node serving locations, which is what Google did. You know, we're sort of looking at this transition away from like, you know, a couple hundred big coal plants to tens of thousands of big solar plants that are a little bit closer to the customer or wind or whatever, batteries, to potentially millions or billions of little generators, which are also even closer to the customer. And when you think about that transition, why do you do that, considering that it's much more complex to manage a highly distributed network than it is to manage a centrally planned network? Well, you do that when you're optimizing for cost, and you do that when you're optimizing for reliability. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things that we will need to be optimizing for as we move forward. And in the same way that that drove a push towards software-defined networking in the internet space, in order to manage that much more distributed and complex system effectively, we really need software that can understand the state of the network at any given point in time, that has the sort of fabric for being able to distribute work across that network in a reliable way, even if none of the workers are reliable and the network isn't reliable either.
Yep. And of course, so you guys focus on grid, and there's roles for software outside of grid, onboard, inside storage, right? Optimizing for the life of the battery.
Yep.
The duration of the charge, like range in the case of a car, the things in buildings, you know.
For sure.
Does it mostly come down to AI, most importantly ML and analytics and management, or you know what are the big like things that software does that are the most important to our clean energy future?
Well, as a former reliability engineer and someone whose job it was to basically build highly reliable systems of which software was a component, I would tell you that the foundation of building a good system is monitoring.
Yep. Okay.
Understanding what's happening with your devices, with your network, with every piece of it, being able to get like a good, you know, kind of historical and real-time view of what all the things are doing is foundational. Mm-hmm. So whether you're talking about batteries or houses or cars or
EVs,
whatever,
yep.
That's always foundational. I think, you know, understanding within that sea of data what you should pay attention to is sort of your next order challenge. And that's where the machine learning pieces and the AI pieces come in, right? Of all of that massive sea of noise that we just collected or created, you know, what's the signal? Where is it important that I should know about something being different? How can you make sure that the majority of those components are self-managing? A lot of that is just kind of block and tackle control theory stuff, you know, making sure that you're making reasonable local decisions, which is frankly better probably without AI than with it. Mm-hmm. But the application for AI technologies in particular, I think, is in this field is probably best suited to pulling signal from noise, really understanding what's out there and what it means.
Yep, yep. Okay. While we're at it, maybe say a bit about hardware. You know, without hardware, software doesn't have anything to run on, right? And without software, hardware is just a chunk of metal or something to that effect. Yeah. How do you think about the role of hardware in electrification?
I think it's a really exciting time to be working in hardware anywhere related to the electrification field. So there's just a lot of stuff to build, right? Like whether that's heat pumps and home heating and control systems, whether that's electrical control systems for things that weren't electrified or weren't smart before, like building control systems and those kinds of things. You know, whether that's like looking at the significantly expanded role for software in managing cars, which for better or worse is absolutely already coming for us. You know, most cars are no longer steered by using a mechanical assemblage, which was the case, you know, for most of their history, and now by fly-by-wire. We really need that software to work. It's a lot of interesting challenges.
Yeah. And steering in particular, brakes.
Update on the fly models, you know, software reliability in the automotive industry, I think is a really interesting space. There's obviously a really big role for software, but on the hardware side, there's just a ton of room for innovation too. You know, as we switch to different power sources, electrical motors are smaller and much more compact and can be put in different places than internal combustion ones, which means that there's an opportunity to really rethink a lot of our physical and built environment. You know, why do cars look like cars? Because you got to put an internal combustion engine in the front and four wheels on the bottom. Like, there's really no reason they couldn't look like, I don't know, giant wheeled tigers or, you know, something entirely different. And so, you know, there's a practical need there. Like, how do you build great engines? How do you build great batteries? How do you build great sensing equipment for the grid? But I think there's also a lot of room for creativity. And that's something I don't think we talk about enough when we talk about the opportunities and challenges of electrification. What could we rethink and do differently in a way that was really fun or exciting that makes the future even better than the world we grew up in?
Let's talk about mission a bit. So one of the main themes of this show is, you know, how your social or environmental mission is a competitive advantage. Can you say a bit about, you know, how you perceive your mission in the business context? Does it help you and how?
I think our mission is really fundamental to the company that we built and to a lot of the way that we conduct business. And that's true in a couple of different ways. You know, firstly, I think the idea that mission can be a liability is a relatively recent one, in the sense that, you know, when I started working at Google, we never talked about the money. We always talked about the mission. And that idea of providing technology that could connect people around the world to information that would be transformative to them was a big part of why everybody came to work every day, which sounds, I don't know, almost a little bit old fashioned now in some ways, but it really meant a lot to me doing that work then. And to, you know, all of my colleagues, that was what we always talked about. What we talked about loving about our job was that sense of mission. And so, you know, that idea that work should be meaningful, that its impact should be positive, is something that I think, you know, people come from different places on. But at least to me, if I'm going to be spending the majority of my waking life doing something, well, firstly, I'd want it to be at least not harmful. And if I have the opportunity, secondarily, I'd really like to be spending my time working on the problems that I think are most pressing and most important. You know, that's a luxury to some degree. Like, that's a luxury that if we're lucky, we reach at a point in our career where we're like, hey, you know, money's nice, but what's it all for anyway? But the idea that, you know, you can really make a difference on problems that you worry about, problems that you care about, on things that impact your kids' well-being, my grandkids' well-being when I have them, that's profoundly meaningful and profoundly motivating, you know, not just to me, but to many, many people out there.
So in a business context, can you think of an example or a story like this come into play in hiring and fundraising and talking to customers? Can you maybe give an example?
Yeah, absolutely. And so mission comes into pretty much 100% of our hiring conversations. And it is usually the reason that people choose to come and work with us instead of making literally twice as much working for Google or Facebook. We are really fortunate to have a lot of great team members and to, I think, have a really great engineering and technology situation where, you know, we can look to recruit from amongst the best folks in the industry, but those people can get a job that pays literally twice as much anywhere else. So if they're going to work for us, it's going to be because they chose the mission, not necessarily because we couldn't match the money. You know, when we talk to customers, it's been interesting because when I first started in this field, coming on 4 years ago, directly, you know, kind of talking to utilities and working with utilities, at the time, I got a lot of advice to not mention decarbonization, just kind of keep it on the down low, talk to them about cost savings. And I would say that while most folks in the energy industry are still really looking at it from a money perspective, there are a lot of people out there, including a lot of utilities, that are doing really important and really innovative work because they are looking to reduce carbon, because they have near-term decarbonization goals. And when that's the case, they'll make potentially a little bit more ambitious technology choices, you know, potentially look to drive more innovation within their organization. And if you can come in with a solution that is not just technologically sound, but also one that is actually designed to solve the problem that they are trying to solve, then I think that's a real advantage.
Got it. Anything else on mission? Like, what advice would you give to founders about, like you said, you know, you were kind of coached to focus on the ROI and not on the not on the environment when you're talking to utilities. What would you say to founders about, you know, to what degree should they wear their mission on their sleeve, or, you know, what's the appropriate time, et cetera?
I think there's a really interesting set of trends around this right now, where if you are a climate-facing business, there is a lot of cash that is available to invest in businesses in this space.
Hallelujah.
And that's a relatively new thing, and it is very, very welcome because it was not the case a few years ago.
Yay.
That means that, you know, if you are mission aligned, there are sources of funding that, you know, can be preferentially allocated to you, but you have to be really serious about it. You have to treat that like a business goal. That has to be part of your core, you know, operating criteria. It has to be one of the goals that you measure and meet. It has to be something that you can identify as being, you know, a business opportunity and not a liability. It's not an excuse to build a business that doesn't work, but it is an opportunity to build a business where at least part of your success criteria are defined by your mission success. And that is actually pretty amazing. The fact that there's so much money out there from people who are looking to help is, I think, a really unique situation for a founder that's looking to start a business in this space, and a big advantage.
Yep. Okay. Do you want to talk just a bit about gender? We're running short on time, but you know, you're in a male-dominated industry, both the utilities and tech, right? And we want to say, you know, what would your advice be to aspiring female founders out there that want to be in climate and software?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the first things that I would say is that while the energy business is still pretty male-dominated, not as much as tech. That was one of the first things I noticed when I started working in this space, was that actually the opportunities to work with other women who are in pretty senior roles increased a lot. There's a lot of female CEOs of utilities. There are a good number of women in really senior roles in the energy industry. In tech, that is less the case. So for me, coming out of tech, it was probably a strict improvement in terms of, you know, there being like potential female mentors, you know, other folks whose experience was more similar to mine, people who might want to join the team. And so that was a really big plus. But I will also say that the gender balance for funding to young companies is pretty profoundly biased away from female and minority founded companies. In general, it is more easy to raise money for your company if you are a majority person and more like the people that you're talking to make investment decisions. And that definitely is something that factors into some subset of conversations that is in a really indefinable way. Now, you never have the counterfactual to your own life, right? Like, I don't know what my experience would look like if I was a male founder. I can tell you that some things that I really value would probably be different. I can tell you that some things would probably be easier, but I can't tell you which ones. And it doesn't really help to dwell on it either. So I think the thing that I would really point to is the availability of community, other people who are working within, you know, this particular subset of the kind of climate tech space, as being a real positive. And that's more than just gender. That's, you know, that's sort of diversity on a bunch of fronts. But I do think that if you want to help address a problem, that is always more easily done with a team that is more reflective of the communities that you're trying to help or trying to serve. And so this is a place where diversity on the team and diversity in, you know, kind of the broader industry is a real asset. And that's something I very much enjoyed about working in the climate space.
Yep. Okay. Well, before we wrap up here, I want to ask you about your personal mission. I just want to say, you know, a couple of complimentary things about Camus. You know, what we're hearing here is that we have a big job in front of us, like an existential job to roll out trillions of dollars worth of electrification hardware, wind and storage and solar. And, you know, we need to electrify buildings. We need to electrify heat sources. We need to electrify heavy industry and transportation. And all of that is going to like make the grid, you know, it's going to put a very heavy load on the grid and it's going to be challenging. And so a fundamental thing that's needed is for someone to manage the grid to be able to do all that. Because if we want to, you know, roll all this stuff out and be a clean energy society, we'll need really, really smart software managing the grid to enable it. And so, you know, hearing what you're doing and the leadership role you're taking is sort of heartwarming because we need it so badly. And it sounds like a somewhat of a cornerstone of getting the job done.
Oh, I really appreciate that.
So we always ask at the end of each discussion, the same question. If I were to say that Astrid is on a mission to what? How would you finish that sentence?
Well, that's easy. Astrid is on a mission to save the world, but more to the point, save the world by building and helping to enable the team of diverse participants from all across this big problem space to tackle the most important problem that we face as a species today. We need to work together to tackle climate change, and that is what I am on a mission to do.
Exciting. Okay, so Astrid Atkinson, co-founder and CEO of Camus Energy, on a mission to save the world.
Heck yeah.
Thanks so much for talking today.
Thank you as well.
Thanks for listening to Mission Driven. To find out more about Better Ventures, visit us at better.vc or on Twitter @BetterVentures.